Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 446, titled Funds and Games, being recorded on February 15th of 2004. More recent For the Record programs are available on Streaming Real Audio at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, and WFMU has also archived the older For the Record programs for download only, also on Real Audio, at a longer URL linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery address and to the Real Audio-equipped For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well at www.spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed annotated article-length description of For the Record program number 446 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com within a week or so of the airing of this program. Listeners who would like to support the work that I'm doing will find a page to click on at the beginning of each For the Record description. Now, we're going to return to the discussion from the book Gold Warriors, subtitled America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold, co-authored by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, published in hardcover by Verso Books and copyright 2003. It was my pleasure to interview Peggy Seagrave on in For the Record program number 428, and we're going to take a look at some more of these post-war slush funds and various political action funds that derive from looted Axis loot, in particular the billions upon billions of dollars that were looted by the Japanese from Asia and that in turn became a pivotal, albeit largely unrecognized, element of the post-World War II political and economic landscapes. The same, of course, is true for the flight capital that was first looted by Nazi Germany and then became the foundation of the Bormann Organization and the post-war Underground Reich. Returning to discussion of the Black Eagle Trust, this was a giant political slush fund that was founded upon enormous amounts of gold, quote, black gold, since it was off the books, that were looted by Japan and also, to a lesser extent, by Nazi Germany as well. This was set up by key members of the Wall Street political axis, in turn, elements associated with, among others, the Bush family as well. The Seagraves write, "The invisible Black Eagle Trust set up by Stimson's team, beefed up by bullion from the Santa Romana recoveries in the Philippines, created a separate pool of black gold that put an extra floor under the post-war economy and gave Washington and its allies covert financial leverage. There are certain similarities between this trust and the diamond cartel identified with De Beers or the gold cartel identified with the Oppenheimer family of South Africa. According to informed sources, these similarities exist for good reason and on many different planes. The diamond cartel was able to amass huge quantities of stones and yet keep prices artificially high by limiting to a trickle the number of diamonds reaching the market, maintaining the impression of extraordinary rarity. In a similar way, the black gold cartel could hold many thousands of metric tons of gold bullion, far more than the official gold supply, keeping gold prices artificially high while discreetly using derivatives of this gold as a clandestine slush fund. If the recovery of this huge mass of plundered gold was known only to a trusted few, those countries and individuals that had been robbed by the Nazis, the fascists, or the Japanese would not sue to recover it. Also, the argument was made that the existence of so much black gold, if it became public knowledge, would cause the fixed price of $35 an ounce to collapse. As so many countries now linked their currencies to the U.S. dollar, and the dollar was linked to gold, currency values throughout the world might then plummet, causing financial disaster. But so long as it was kept secret, gold prices could be kept at $35 an ounce, and currencies pegged to gold would remain stable. Meanwhile, the black gold would serve as a reserve asset, bolstering the prime banks in each country and strengthening the governments of those nations. As a safeguard, the black gold placed in those banks was earmarked or strictly limited in the uses that could be made of it. This enabled Washington to bring pressure from time to time on those governments' central banks and prime banks. So long as a country and its leaders cooperated with Washington and remained allied to it in the Cold War, the sleeping bullion would provide the asset base for patronage. Gold bearer certificates and other derivatives could be given as gifts or bribes, without actually giving away the bullion itself. Beneficial trusts could be set up in behalf of certain statesmen, military leaders, or political figures, or their families. In the hands of clever men like Anderson and McCloy, the possibilities were endless. From time to time, as more bullion was recovered from gold lily vaults in the Philippines, quantities of the bullion would be offered in strictest secrecy to central banks or to consortiums of private buyers. In later chapters, we will see numerous documented instances when these underground funds surfaced as huge bribes or were used to buy elections, famously in Italy, Greece, and Japan, but probably in other countries as well. Some internationally famous banks appear to have become addicted to having billions of dollars of this black gold in their vaults. So addicted that they refuse to surrender the bullion and in some cases have stooped to swindling the original owners or their heirs by denouncing their documents as counterfeit. Indeed, some owners claim that not only were they told their documents were fake, but were given veiled threats of murder if they pressed their claims. In some cases, the banks may have made such heavy use of these black gold reserves that they no longer are in a position to relinquish the bullion without going under. So again, note the consummate importance of the Black Eagle Trust, not only for post-war clandestine political life, but also as a foundational element of a hidden and yet vitally important, pivotally important economic element as well. What we're going to look at next are the genesis of the M Fund or Marquardt Fund, the Yatsuya Fund, and the Keenan Fund. First, the M Fund. This was a political action fund that was basically created from the Japanese loot, looted under Golden Lily, and used for the political rehabilitation of key Japanese fascist political figures and for the manipulation of post-war Japanese political life. The Seagraves write, "In this context of intense corruption and artful misrepresentation, it was inevitable that the political action funds America set up in Japan would be diverted. But the corruption, dishonesty, and moral turpitude cannot be blamed only on the Japanese. Americans were involved in diverting the funds, benefited from their abuse, and may still be benefiting today in a multitude of ways. Three underground funds were controlled by American officials during the occupation, the M Fund, the Yatsuya Fund, and the Keenan Fund. According to Takano Hajime, the M Fund was named after General William Frederick Marquardt, chief of ESCAP's economic and scientific section. In theory, marked by the ESCAP was the occupation authority in post-war Japan, in theory, Marquardt headed America's program to punish and reform Japanese businesses that had gorged on war profiteering. In reality, Marquardt's biggest public relations headache was how to help them conceal these obscene profits, which by custom were shared with the imperial family. Historian John Dower explains that Marquardt, quote, assumed responsibility for nothing less than supervising all developments in finance, economics, labor, and science, including the dissolution of Zaibatsu holding companies and the promotion of economic deconcentration. Every major governmental, financial, and economic institution reported to his section, including the Ministry of Finance, the Ministry of Commerce and Industry, and the Bank of Japan. Little has been written about Marquardt, who usually is portrayed as an amiable nincompoop, unfit for the job. This hardly comes as a surprise. Like Generals Willoughby and Whitney, Marquardt was one of MacArthur's inner circle, the Bataan Boys, whose chief quality was undying loyalty. John Gunther said Marquardt, quote, pays little attention to the jargon of his present field. Once he turned to his first assistant during a heavy conference on economic affairs, saying, "What is marginal economy anyway?" unquote. Marquardt was supposed to dissolve the banks and conglomerates that financed Japan's war and profited from it. Despite purely cosmetic changes and the breakup and sale of several small conglomerates, the biggest war profiteers were let off without even a slap on the wrist. General Marquardt was also in charge of closing down and punishing Japan's Biological and Chemical Warfare Service Unit, Unit 731. Instead, the U.S. government secretly absorbed Unit 731, moving most of its scientists, personnel, and documents to U.S. military research centers like Fort Detrick in the Maryland countryside. All information about its activities, including biological warfare atrocities and horrific experiments on fully conscious victims, was withheld by Washington from the American and Japanese public and from the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunals. All Unit 731's records held by the U.S. government are still top secret. So while he was supposed to be making Japan more democratic, Marquardt was doing exactly the opposite. The M Fund was created to buy elections for Japanese politicians so far to the right that they were solidly anti-communist. Japan was the most highly industrialized country in Asia, and so Washington wanted it to be a capitalist bastion against communism for its economy to thrive so that there would be no need for labor unions, leftist organizers, or revolution. This was the view of American conservatives who thought President Roosevelt was a communist and believed that Britain should have allied itself with Germany and Japan and gone to war against the USSR. As a consequence of this thinking, plans to reform Japan were truncated or aborted. One major exception was land reform successfully completed before it could be halted. The first big application of the M Fund was in the late 1940s when a socialist government happened to win an election in Japan, a development that astonished, panicked, and galvanized SCAP. Immediately, great sums were distributed by SCAP to discredit the socialist cabinet and to replace it with a regime more to Washington's liking. Later, when Tokyo considered establishing relations with the People's Republic of China, sums again were dispersed to get Japan back on the right track. When Yoshida Shiroguro became prime minister, Washington relaxed because Yoshida was trusted, conservative, and personally very rich. During his period as prime minister, the M Fund was called the Yoshida Fund. After he ceased to be prime minister, the name reverted to M Fund. In a conversation in 1987, White House National Security Advisor Richard Allen said, "All my life I've heard of a thing called the Yoshida Fund. I think that's the same thing as the M Fund," unquote. Very different from the M Fund was the Yotsuya Fund. This fund was set up to manipulate and steer Japan's underworld and to finance, quote, wet work, unquote, extortion, kidnapping, and murder. General Charles Willoughby, MacArthur's lovable fascist and head of G2 at SCAP, controlled the Yotsuya Fund and worked energetically with Yoshio Kodama and his legions of Yakuza to suppress any kind of leftist activity or public protest during the occupation. By the way, the M Fund also had an additive to it, and that was a large sum of money that had been pirated from occupied Asia by the aforementioned Yoshio Kodama. A small element about this, because this acts as something of a transition element from the discussion of the M Fund to discussion of the Yotsuya Fund. Another great fortune discovered by U.S. intelligence services in 1946 was $13 billion in war loot amassed by underworld godfather Kodama Yoshio, who was, as a rear admiral in the Imperial Navy, working with Golden Lily in China and Southeast Asia, was in charge of plundering the Asian underworld and racketeers. He was also in charge of Japan's wartime drug trade throughout Asia. After the war, to get out of Sugamo prison and avoid prosecution for war crimes, Kodama gave $100 million to the CIA, which was added to the M Fund's coffers. Kodama then personally financed the creation of the two political parties that merged into Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP, strongly backed to this day by Washington, and then of the Yotsuya Fund, allied with not only the MacArthur staff, but the Japanese underworld and the aforementioned Yoshio Kodama. Very different from the M Fund was the Yotsuya Fund. This was set up to manipulate and steer Japan's underworld and to finance wet work, extortion, kidnapping, and murder. General Willoughby, MacArthur's lovable fascist and head of G2 at ASCAP, controlled the Yotsuya Fund and worked energetically with Kodama and his legions of Yakuza to suppress any kind of leftist activity or public protest during the occupation. Because democracy tolerated dissent, the concept of democracy had long been regarded by Japan's ruling elite as, quote, a poisonous idea from the West, unquote. In Japan, even the mildest kind of dissent was not tolerated. During the McCarthy era in America, the suppression of dissent became synonymous with anti-communism. But the witch hunt in Japan during that epoch, was far more severe and bloody. Despite being head of G2, at this late stage in his career, Willoughby was involved in dirty tricks rather than intelligence gathering or counter-espionage. Among other things, his Yotsuya Fund financed a Korean liaison office that sent spies into North Korea, Red China, and the far eastern USSR. Yotsuya, the district for which Willoughby named his underground fund, was a seedy Tokyo tenderloin populated in the post-war years by gangsters, prostitutes, and bottom feeders, a hub for the black market, awake all night with illegal gambling casinos and attached brothels. Today, Yotsuya has changed and is famous for bars frequented by university students and company executives. Kickbacks from post-war dives like the Mandarin Club, a casino and brothel in Yotsuya run by American Ted Lewin, a pal of Kodama, funded the Cannon Agency, Willoughby's dirtiest and wettest operation in Japan. Named for U.S. Army Colonel J.Y. Cannon, this was a military version of Murder Incorporated, a death squad in Japan. Jack Cannon arranged the beating and killings of student leaders, liberals, leftists, socialists, labor union organizers, scholars, journalists, and anyone else who got in the way. Cannon worked closely with Machi Hisayuki, Kodama's Korean lieutenant who headed the ethnic Korean Tosekai gang of Yakuza. Jack Cannon initially worked for the U.S. Army's Counterintelligence Corps, or CIC. His job was to ferret out and to murder Japanese political dissidents. A Nisei interpreter employed by Willoughby's ATIS, who once had helped Cannon blow open a safe, recalled that the colonel always behaved like, quote, a movie-style gangster, unquote. Once the Cannon Agency was set up, Jack Cannon became something that would have chilled the blood of most Americans. He is thought to have been behind the kidnapping of a prominent left-wing writer, Keiji Watoru. Also attributed to him was the torture, dismemberment, and murder of Shimoyama, the president of Japan's National Railroads, whose body was found scattered along the railroad tracks. Whenever he needed a hand, Cannon called on Machii's Korean Yakuza. He also was suspected of arranging plane crashes that took the lives of British and American diplomats and military officers who were investigating the links between Willoughby and indicted war criminals like Kodama and Colonel Tsuji Masanobu. When the job was so wet and dirty that it had to be completely divorced from Washington, Willoughby bypassed Cannon and brought in a murder squad called KATO, K-A-T-O-H, the acronym of five Japanese army officers who did surgical assassinations for money. To be sure, what makes this even more disturbing is that Willoughby was judged by U.S. Army contemporaries to be incompetent, paranoid, and congenitally driven to cover up his misjudgments. As most documents relating to Willoughby's activities still are kept hidden by the U.S. government half a century later, we may reasonably suppose that there is yet more disturbing information on his messianic activities. The Keenan Fund, by contrast, was controlled by a civilian. Joseph B. Keenan, another MacArthur intimate who was chief prosecutor in the Tokyo war crimes trials. Previously, Keenan had been chief of the U.S. Justice Department's criminal division, where he acquired a reputation for gang-busting and heavy boozing. His appointment as chief war crimes prosecutor in Tokyo was criticized because he was not considered a good enough lawyer, knew nothing of Asia, and was a shameless headline seeker. Many thought Keenan got the job because President Truman personally disliked him and wanted him out of Washington. In Japan, Keenan's personal assistant was none less than General Tanaka Takeyoshi, the bull-like Tariki Ronin who was General Doihara's alter ego in Manchuria, the cold-blooded manipulator of Puyi's young Empress Elizabeth. Tanaka spent the late 1930s and early 1940s in Shanghai with Doihara, running covert operations. Like Doihara, he personally carried out many individual murders. The idea that he was suited to babysit America's chief war crimes prosecutor in post-war Tokyo is black humor at its best. It was common gossip among journalists in Tokyo, as it had been in Washington, that Keenan had a severe drinking problem and, quote, liked the ladies excessively. General Tanaka took charge of Keenan's date book, accompanied him to inns and brothels to carry out these assignations, and when Keenan passed out, he got him safely home. Unlike the broad mandates of the M Fund and the Yotsuya Fund, the Keenan Fund had a narrow and specific function. Simply put, it was used to bribe witnesses at the war crimes trials or to grease the intermediaries who persuaded the witnesses to falsify their testimony. Unlike the swift punishment meted out to Generals Yamashita and Hama in Manila, The war crimes tribunal in Tokyo dragged on for 3 years while a lot of horse trading took place. The tribunal had been established to try General Tojo and other senior military and civilian leaders for complicity in Japan's cruel aggression. Although the tribunal was labeled an international commission, the whole operation was carried out exclusively by MacArthur's inner circle. In the charter establishing the tribunal, MacArthur invested himself with broad powers, and the tribunal was kept under his sole and exclusive authority. As a final touch, the charter written by MacArthur and Keenan stated, quote, "The tribunal shall not be bound by technical rules of evidence." Accordingly, MacArthur's men were able to control access to the defendants, to suborn whoever they wished, and to arrange omissions of evidence. Money changed hands secretly to assure scapegoats that their families would be cared for. And then the authors go on to relate some of the information that they presented in their previous book, The Yamato Dynasty, and that we discussed in For the Record program number 426, skipping down. Bribes from the Keenan Fund also were used to prevent testimony about Japan's biological and chemical warfare program and the vast scale of looting carried out by the Imperial Family's Golden Lily operation. We now know that the U.S. government and other allied governments browbeat POWs when they were liberated from Japanese slave labor camps. They were bullied into signing secrecy oaths before they were allowed to go home, forced to swear that they would not reveal anything they knew about war looting, or about the chemical and biological weapons testing of Unit 731. Even men who had been victims of Japanese medical experiments were forced to take this oath. At the time, they were told it was their patriotic duty to remain silent. Today, those who survive are realizing that they were victimized by their own governments, which were less interested in justice than in staying in power and preparing for the coming Cold War. The last one we're going to talk about is the Showa Trust. In the early 1980s, there was another bizarre development when Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos learned of an extraordinary secret account set up with Golden Lily plunder after the Pacific War. This was the billion-dollar gold bullion trust at Sanwa Bank in Osaka, set up in the names of General MacArthur and Emperor Hirohito, mentioned in Chapter 9. The Japanese call it the MacArthur Fund, while Americans call it the Showa Trust, using the name of Hirohito's reign period. Sanwa Bank is one of Japan's oldest, and Hirohito owned a large chunk of its stock from before World War II. The trust appears to have been set up by Robert B. Anderson shortly after he toured the Golden Lily treasure sites in the Philippines with MacArthur and Lansdale. Although MacArthur's name is identified with it, it does not appear to have been intended to benefit MacArthur, at least not directly. As for Hirohito, according to journalist Paul Manning, who had access to SCAP records during an early stage of the U.S. occupation, the emperor had $1 billion in gold and currencies hidden in overseas accounts since before the war. The emperor was pulling in $50 million a year in interest from overseas investments during the U.S. occupation, and SCAP financial advisors were aware of these income-producing assets. Significantly, Sanwa Bank was one of three Japanese banks left untouched by General Marquardt's economic and scientific section of SCAP. The other two were Tokai Bank and Daiichi Kangyo Bank, involved in the Tanaka Club disbursements growing out of the M Fund. Today, Sanwa Bank advertises its worldwide banking operations with the slogan, "We've come a long way," unquote. Indeed. Then the authors go on to describe how Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos tried to basically blackmail both the Japanese and American governments over the Showa Trust. Initially, the American government was open to this because they were hoping to use Marcos-recovered Golden Lily gold to underwrite what were known as the Rainbow Dollars. The Reagan administration early on was going to try to restore the United States to the gold standard using gold that had been looted by the Marcoses, and in turn accessing gold that had been looted by the Japanese. And ultimately, that scheme fell through, and that resulted in the ouster of the Marcoses. Now, we've talked about the funds. What we're going to talk about now are the games. After discussing the threats delivered to Jean Ziegler, a Swiss professor and parliamentarian, after he exposed the looted Nazi loot that was in Swiss bank accounts, he was then charged by treason by Swiss federal prosecutor Carla Del Ponte, a law partner of Pier Felice Barchi, who is the attorney for Altaqua's Youssef Nada, and also handles the Swiss investments for Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. Then the authors go on to describe threats delivered to themselves. We have been threatened with murder before. When we published the Sung Dynasty, we were warned by a senior CIA official that a hit team was being assembled in Taiwan to come to murder us. He said, "I would take this very seriously if I were you." We vanished for a year to an island off the coast of British Columbia. While we were gone, a Taiwan hit team arrived in San Francisco and shot dead the Chinese-American journalist Henry Liu. When we published the Marcos Dynasty, we expected trouble from the Marcos family and its cronies, but instead we were harassed by Washington. Others had investigated Marcos, but we were the first to show how the U.S. government was secretly involved with Marcos gold deals. We came under attack from the U.S. Treasury Department and its Internal Revenue Service, whose agents made threatening midnight phone calls to our elderly parents. Arriving in New York for an author tour, one of us was intercepted at JFK Airport, passport seized, and held incommunicado for 3 hours. Eventually, the passport was returned without a word of explanation. When we ran Freedom of Information queries to see what was behind it, we were grudgingly sent a copy of a telex message on which every word was blacked out, including the date. The justification given for this censorship was the need to protect government sources, which were above the law. During one harassing phone call from a U.S. Treasury agent, he said he was sitting in his office watching an interview we had done for a Japanese TV network, an interview broadcast only in Japanese, which we had never seen. After publishing the Yamato Dynasty, which briefly mentioned the discovery that is the basis for gold warriors, our phones and email were tapped. We know this because when one of us was in a European clinic briefly for a medical procedure, the head nurse reported that, quote, "someone posing as your American doctor," unquote, had been on the phone asking questions. When a brief extract of this book was published in the South China Morning Post in August of 2001, several phone calls from the editors were cut off suddenly. Emails from the newspaper took 72 hours to reach us, while copies sent to an associate nearby arrived instantly. In recent months, we have begun to receive veiled death threats. What have we done to provoke murder? To borrow a phrase from Jean Ziegler, we are combating official amnesia. We live in dangerous times, like Germany in the 1930s, when anyone who makes inconvenient disclosures about hidden assets can be branded a terrorist or a traitor, skipping down. Despite the best efforts of the American and Japanese governments to destroy, withhold, or lose documentation related to Golden Lily, we have accumulated thousands of documents, conducted thousands of hours of interviews, and we make all of these available to readers of this book on two compact discs available from our website www.bowstring.net so they can make up their own minds. We encourage others with knowledge of these events to come forward. When the top is corrupt, the truth will not come from the top. It will emerge in bits and pieces from people like Jean Ziegler and Christoph Miley, who decided they had to, quote, do something. As a precaution, should anything odd happen, we have arranged for this book and all its documentation to be put on the Internet at a number of sites. If we are murdered, readers will have no difficulty figuring out who they, unquote, are. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 446, titled Funds and Games, being recorded on February 15th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.